You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
I'm going to give a short intro today, and just to welcome Josh and Anna from CamCycle, who are leading us in this kind of discussion session, and you'll be interactive. I hope you've already got a pipe cleaner. If you haven't, Rory will find one for you. And without further ado, I will hand over to Josh and Anna, who will lead you through what we're doing this evening. So thank you all very much.
Hello, everybody. Welcome, Greenbelt. We are so pleased to be with you in the hot house today. Hello, everybody. Is that better? Yay! I'll start again. We are so pleased to be with you in the hot house today, sandwiched between some absolutely amazing guests, writers and speakers that are on in this tent today. So we're really glad to be with you. My name's Anna. This is my colleague, Josh. We both work for CamCycle, which is a cycle advocacy charity based in Cambridge. And our aim is to deliver more cycling for a better future for everyone. And we also work as part of the Cambridgeshire Sustainable Travel Alliance, so working to deliver more sustainable options and choice from rail and buses to walking and wheeling.
We both bring different motivations and skills to the role. So my background's in engineering, and I think about the way that we can change the streets to make sustainable travel easier. I care about shaping those places so that people can make easier journeys and improve their quality of life.
And my background is in communications and engagement. I am really motivated to help create really strong and active communities, and that's active in both senses of the word. So getting more people moving and healthier, but also more active in working for change. So together we can protect each other, care for each other, and work together to tackle the challenges of the climate crisis.
We've got a great panel here today to talk about travelling green and feeling free because of it. But what exactly does transport freedom mean? Well, we think it's the ability to travel easily, affordably, and safely, with a genuine choice of how we travel, no matter what your age or ability. So when we have a selection of transport choices, it affects how we feel. And even if you don't take certain transport choices, knowing that you can is really important.
But we've also got to think about how the choices we have and our own transport freedom might affect other people's quality of life. So really our aim is for a place where people, no matter their age or situation in life, have a really kind of steady amount of transport freedom throughout their life, but it's not negatively affecting other people's quality of life. And that could be people in your local community. So for example, through air pollution or road danger, or that could be also our broader neighbours around the world. So thinking about our carbon emissions from fossil fuel transport, such as cars and planes.
So there's always trade-offs when we make choices about travel. So walking, for instance, it's the most kind of grounded human mode of transport that we have. And yet it's quite slow. So that's a problem. Cycling allows
sometimes
us...
Sometimes it's nice to be slow.
Yeah, know? It's lovely to be slow. Yeah. Cycling, well, it allows us to maximise that human output and travel at far greater distances. But the downside is you could be cycling to Greenbelt and your chain snaps in half in the middle of nowhere.
And you nearly have to leave your co-chair to do it on the road.
Yeah. Most people will live near a bus stop, but how often are those buses running? And how many stops will you have to endure on the bus? Train travel can be fast, but how do you get to the station, and how do you afford your ticket? And then there's the car. It's the ultimate freedom at the moment of choice. You can just get in there and get to where you need to be. But what are the barriers to driving, and how many people can actually drive? And then when we choose to drive, what are the consequences of kind of that loss of movement and physical activity, as well as the places that we want to drive to are often pretty negatively affected by that choice?
And our, throughout our lives, our personal sense of transport freedom can vary. And one really useful way to think about this, and this is credit to Chris and Melissa Bruntlett, for anybody who's read any of their books, is to sort of map it out as a graph. So if you think about the x-axis being our age, and the y-axis being the amount of transport freedom, you can sort of map how that might go up and down throughout your life. So typically, you know, as you grow older through your teenage years, your transport freedom tends to increase as you become less dependent on your parents. And maybe as you become a parent yourself, it might dip and you've got little babies and toddlers to get around, might rise again in midlife, and then might slowly decrease as you get older and your mobility is a bit less. But also, yeah, external things can happen as well to affect like those ups and downs. So you might move from the country to a city and suddenly you've got much better cycle paths or bus services, or, you know, something might happen that you break your leg. Suddenly you can't drive, or, you know, it's harder to walk around as well.
Because much of our places are built around the car, it invariably leads to quite steep transport curves for people. So they, you know, might get to 17 and pass their driving test and their mobility and transport freedoms dramatically increase. But then later in life, they might lose that freedom, and then that can lead to isolation. So we need more transport choice so that our freedoms feel steadier for longer. And that kind of means more options about how to get around.
So we're just about to go to our brilliant panel of guests here to find out more about their transport freedoms and their experiences. But before we do that, it'd be really nice to get to know a bit more about all you lovely people in the tent and your experiences. And to sort of lead us into that, I thought I'd talk about there's a researcher in New Zealand called Professor Janet Stevenson. And one of the really interesting things she found was that people have quite different perspectives on freedom, and that there sort of can be equal and opposing views of what freedom looks like. So there are one group of people who actually feel more free with a car, but another group of people without a car actually felt more free because they didn't have to have a car. They didn't have to rely on it to get around. Maybe they had good options and they felt like they had the choice whether they could have a car or not. So I'd be really interested if you could put your hand up if at this moment in your life you feel more free without a car or not having to drive too much. Okay, we've got quite a good number there. And what about the people who at the moment feel more free with a car, having a car? Great, thank you. That's yeah, probably
pretty good split.
50-50, yeah?
Yeah. Okay, now on to our guests to hear from their perspective. So we've got Rosa Williams, who's 13 and lives and cycles around Cambridge. Alan Aykroyd, also from Cambridge, who rediscovered cycling after treatment for cancer. Katie Renker, who works for Wheels for Wellbeing and also has adventures by wheelchair and hand cycle. And Laura Laker, a transport journalist and author.
Okay, so Rosa, let's start with you. You're in a lovely big chair there. Can you sum up in a sentence what transport freedom means to you?
Transport freedom means that I have more independence and I can spend more time with my friends and family while doing it safely.
Can you tell us a bit more about that and a bit more about your story and experiences?
My name's Rosa, I'm 13 years old and I live in Cambridge. We have 5 people in our family and we live without a car. One of the best things about our city is that it's easy to get around by bike and lots of people cycle. I've been cycling on the road with my parents since I was 4, and I now ride around independently, to school, to football practice and matches, to rowing, to friends' houses and to the shops. Most of the time when I'm cycling, I feel safe. Some routes are away from cars and some are protected cycle lanes. The cycle lanes on one of the main roads near us has recently been improved, which encourages a lot more people to cycle. Being able to get places by yourself means you can spend more time with your friends and don't have to wait for your parents to pick you up. When I have to travel a bit further to play football matches, I mostly go with my parents on public transport, but sometimes get a lift from friends' parents. We get trains and buses to neighbouring villages. In Cambridge, we have a Tiger bus pass system, which means under 16s can travel one journey for £1. Being able to get Well, when we go on holiday, we also use public transport. We've travelled by train to Skye, Cornwall and France, and we walk and use buses to explore the places we stay. Using trains means you can spend more time together. We play card games such as Sushi Go and Uno Flip. Sometimes it's hard travelling like this when trains are cancelled and buses aren't reliable. Once we had to wait in a telephone box at a rural station near my grandparents' house for a lift because it was Christmas and it was cold. But our worst journey was probably in the hire car to Cornwall when we got stuck in traffic and it took us 11 hours. I think around the UK we need more cheap and reliable public transport to help more people use it and better cycle networks so that people feel safe on the roads. I think every 13-year-old deserves the right to walk or cycle to school if they want to.
I love that. Okay, over to you, Alan. What does transport freedom mean for you?
They said, you follow Rosa. Yeah. Transport freedom for me means being able to choose. I want to take you back about 40 years. One day, I was leaning against the side of my car, gripping the petrol pump trigger, as you do, and a penny dropped. This is oil. I'd been listening to the radio while I was driving. Oil is amazing stuff. It can make a huge number of different chemicals. It can make plastics. It can be used for lubrication. It can do countless things. And I was pouring it into a tin can so that I could put, from one traffic queue to the next. Now, I thought about this for the next few days. And I got incredibly upset and angry because I realised that I wanted to stop using my car. It was something that just didn't sit right with me. But I couldn't. I was tied in to using a car to earn my living, to give my family the opportunities and the resources that they needed. I went through all the stuff about economic driving, you know, not accelerating and decelerating as much, you know, at speed and lumping together your journeys and all the rest of it, but I was still tied to that damn car. And I was like that for years. And that was my lowest point of transport freedom, particularly when I lived in the village of Steeple Bumpstead. Yeah, it is a real place, okay? It's not quite the end of the world, but you can see it from there. And the thing is, there was one pub, there were two churches, there was a tiny village shop, and there was a primary school. Everything else with a young family, we had to get out of the village, and that involved climbing some steep hills on roads where people drove like maniacs. We had to have a car, and we were using it every other day, and I hated it. That was my lowest point of transport freedom. How about somebody else?
Okay, over to Laura.
So for me it's about choice. I think that's kind of the start and end of it. It's about having options to go where you want when you want to. My kind of journey into being interested in transport, which I never thought I would be interested in, I was studying nutrition. And I got a summer job at Transport for London, writing letters. I thought, you know, I want to be a journalist, so writing letters for Transport for London is a good start. And my job was to answer letters about the red routes in London, which is like the 5% of roads that Transport for London runs. And I would answer letters about complaining about drains that made a bumping noise when people drove over them and were disturbing people's sleep, or I'd get questions about traffic light phasing. And it's, you know, it was kind of a fairly easy job, But I started to realise over time how fundamentally transport affects all of us and affects our lives. And, you know, when it works, we kind of don't notice it. But when it doesn't work, it can have such a huge impact on our lives. And so, you know, answering questions about the Blackwall Tunnel, and the people get really angry about that, and whether motorbikes should go in bus lanes, and how safe that was for cycling. And I remember talking to a friend about it, and I just saw her eyes glazing over. And I was like, you know, this is really important stuff. And she was like, yeah. Anyway, but yeah, I mean, it just sort of dawned on me at that point. Maybe that was the start of my obsession. And then I discovered cycling, and then it was just a hopeless case from there onwards. But I don't know, it kind of brings me to a story that I heard the former Transportation Commissioner of New York tell. And she spoke to her grandmother, who said, if you want to touch people's lives, either go into transportation or sanitation. And she decided it was transportation was the more fun option of the two. But it's true, it really does have a fundamental impact on everything. And it's been described as a sort of policy enabler for every other kind of area of our lives, for health, so how you get around affects your health, for your well-being, for your ability to access jobs and education. You know, I've spoken to tons of people over the 12 or 13 years that I've been writing about transport and cycling, people for whom transport has, you know, stopped them, or lack of transport has stopped them from being able to get to employment, or to meet people, or, you know, makes them very isolated if they can't get around. And yeah, the, you know, 12 years later, I still feel as strongly that this is an amazing thing that, you know, we need to have in our lives in order to live full lives, be part of society, be healthy, you know, be economically active, and all of those important things. So yeah, I just think it's a really important thing that on the face of it could seem boring, but actually the more you learn about it, the more important I think it is. So
I think now over to Katie, who can probably illustrate some of the things that that Laura's just been touching on there, how important it is to your life and health.
So my name's Katie. I am a formerly legged eco-zealot and adventure lover, and now a less functioning legged and more wheeled eco-zealot and adventure lover. In a kind of broad spread, what transport freedom means to me is to be able to get to the places that I want to or need to go somewhat spontaneously with the most independence possible. How that looks has changed a lot. In some ways, I'm a lot more dependent on physical infrastructure, other people, the equipment that I have, for example, my hand cycle, which is down there, which means that I'm tied to those things in sometimes beautiful and interesting ways, and sometimes frustrating or even scary ways. And there's a lot of variables that change how that looks. It could be level access to a tube that could give me that freedom, or it could mean cycling across 11 countries on a hand cycle, where the mixture of trains and having gaps bridged by being carried onto inaccessible transport by your ex-boyfriend. So it could be using them as a viable form of transport as well. But yeah, it's varied a lot.
Thank you. And and before this session, we asked all our panelists to map out their transport freedom curves. And so should we have a look at that? And we, Josh and I, and maybe a little helper. Can we have a little helper? I was going to try and illustrate this so that everybody can see a bit better. So first of all, let's start with Rosa's. So which way is you getting more freedom or less freedom? So, okay, so for the audience, turn it around. Okay, so we need it to go from low to high. And can we have a few bumps in there? Hi, Res. Yeah, there's a few little bumps. But generally, it's kind of low to high, fairly straightforward. Okay, that was Rosa's. So now should we try and map out Alan's? Go along to, okay. Ooh, interesting. Like a bit like a sort of saucepan, is that? Kind of going down a bit and then along and then very sort of steep up like a saucepan kind of handle. Okay, now Laura's. Ooh, this is like a bit of a sort of hills. We've got quite a bump. And then a bit more smooth curve at the end. Okay. And then finally, Katie.
So I've decided to give you a challenge.
Oh my goodness.
And I'll kind of talk you through it as we do it. Okay. So we start off with this kind of straight line. I grew up in the capital of Sri Lanka, in Colombo, which was very much not a kind of walkable or cyclable city. So I was fully dependent on lifts, couldn't even walk to a friend's house or go to any extracurricular activities. Then I moved to Cardiff to do a degree in music, and I was suddenly met with public transport that I could get whenever I want, the equivalent of Boris bikes that I could jump on, and I could walk all the way around the city. So freedom really peaked. And then what you don't expect is smashing your head into the bottom of a lake and ending up paralyzed from your arms down. So that kind of zapped a lot of that transport freedom away when you're sitting in ICU for half a year. And we kind of hit our rock bottom. And then as I slowly learnt to navigate the world with just my arms and got access to more equipment and tips about how to survive that way, it steadily increased. And now I reckon I'm still definitely a lot higher than my childhood version and slightly lower than my peak 22-year-old swanning around Krakow and backpacking everywhere, but with a lot more kind of bumps and adventures in the way.
Great, thank you.
Yeah. So many great stories from our panelists there, from just wanting to get to school to being Alan stuck in a made-up village is what I got from yours. To nearly having a career in sanitary and overcoming the adversity and gaining your transport freedom again. So
now, everybody, it's over to you. You should have a pipe cleaner of your own. If you haven't, let us know. I think there are some more at the front. Where's Rory? Oh, Rory's just at the back, actually, just coming round. Just put your hand up if you haven't got one. And if you prefer to draw it on a piece of paper or use your body or whatever works for you, have a little bit of think about your transport freedom curve and what that might look like. What are some of the things that have increased transport freedom for you throughout your life? What are some of the bits that have decreased it? And we'll just give you a few minutes to do that, a couple of minutes. Just while we're getting going, just to give us another sort of tone of the room, if you could have a think, who in the room thinks they might be at the peak of their transport freedom right now at their current age and stage?
One behind you.
So what do we think? That's about a quarter?
Yeah, a quarter.
And who thinks they might be on a bit of a dip or a downward curve at this stage? Okay, great. Thank you.
Okay. Some of our ups and downs in the transport freedom pass are a result of personal circumstances, and the others are influenced by external factors. There's obviously an interplay between these two. For example, it might be a personal decision to move to a house with poor public transport access, but you may have been forced to do that through housing prices. For simplicity's sake, in this conversation, we're going to explore these two things separately. So personal circumstance and those external influences. And let's go to our panel. So
Rosa first. So you've got a few bumps. You had quite a smooth curve, but a few bumps. So what sort of things in what bumps in the curve do you think came from personal circumstances?
So for my football, I've had quite a few sports injuries, and that means I'm not able to cycle as much, and I have to walk places like school and things. And also my dad, his eyes were deteriorating or like getting worse a bit, so he couldn't drive, and that meant that we haven't been using hire cars for about a year and a half now, which means we have to get on all our holidays or places that are slightly further than we can cycle by train, which is sometimes not as reliable as you think it is.
Okay, Alan, over to you on personal circumstance.
Okay, I've got a few more grey hairs and a bit longer story than Rosa, but
Yeah, so 7 years ago, I suddenly, out of the blue, found that I'd got cancer and had to go through surgery and chemotherapy and all the rest of it. And they sat me down at the end of that and said, if you don't want to be back here, you need to get yourself fit and active. So I pulled the bike out of the shed that had been there for years and started to ride it. That was quite a feat, because when they let me out of hospital, I could just about walk the length of the ward with a frame. But we started to get there, and there were one or two bumps and scrapes on the way. I remember there was one particular sort of what I regard now as a relatively slight incline on my cycle journey into the centre of town. The first time I did it, I thought my lungs were going to burst. But I kept going a little bit further, a little bit faster. Since I didn't have a job to do anymore, I was able to ride most days. And I started very small, just round the square where I lived the first day. But we began to get there. And that was a huge point of change in my life. The cancer stopped me from working and enabled me to be able to develop my freedom in a whole lot of different areas of life. And I'm going to go on and talk about the point when I feel most free transport-wise, and that's now, because about 8 months ago, we sold the car! Yeah! We finally managed to get rid of the thing. I'm dealing with my second lot of cancer now, and I started to get some secondaries in my brain, so I had to give up my driving license. It's all being treated and I'm okay. I've not got that excuse for my innate daftness now. But that precipitated a tremendous change. Now I'm able to move about the town on my bike. We've been able to move into the centre of town. So we have got all of the resources that Cambridge has got to offer within walking distance. We've got a supermarket within 150 yards. We've got a choice of two railway stations, 20 minutes bike ride away from each one. And I've got an old Codgers rail card, and my bike goes on the train for nothing, and it's great. But I am incredibly fortunate because I can afford to do that. People who have less resources to choose where they live generally have to move out of town where housing is cheaper and are forced to drive because rural bus services are accessed via a calendar rather than a watch regarding the timetable. It's not fair. But I'm incredibly fortunate and I'm enjoying the greatest transport freedom now that I've ever had, combining bus and train and bike and old Shank's pony. And I'm going to boast about it anyway, because I'm 67 and the week before last I cycled the south to the north of Wales. And thank you. And I am being treated for cancer, and if I can do something like that, what are you hanging about at?
Wow, that was a bold challenge to everybody. How about you, Laura? Is there something that particularly influenced you in your personal circumstances to get you into cycling and into writing about cycling?
I grew up in the countryside in rural West Somerset, and the road outside of my house was 60 miles an hour narrow single carriageway road, and basically it was too, you couldn't really walk or cycle on it. It was too dangerous. So there was a little forest track that we used to go along that was flat, and we'd go to one end and then come back again. And I was desperate to cycle to school, but I couldn't because, you know, it wasn't safe. So I was stuck with that. And yeah, and just stopped cycling until I moved to London, basically. And a friend at university was cycling in every day, and she kind of encouraged me to do the same. And then that's kind of what opened my eyes to cycling. Yeah, that's kind of been my journey. But I think, you know, what I spoke about before, it's just kind of understanding how important how we get around is. And also just kind of fell in love with being on the bike, actually. I just thought, you know, how wonderful is this thing? It's getting around under your own steam. It's freedom. It's, you know, all your senses. You're cycling through the city. You really get to feel like you know a place when you're on the bike. And yeah, and I think having experienced the rural and the urban has given me a good sense of the different challenges that people face around the country, and kind of helps me understand different people's perspectives. So yeah.
Thanks, Laura. Katie, you've already touched on this a bit, but perhaps you can go deeper into rediscovering that transport freedom after you were paralyzed.
So if I run through the main forms of transport that I mentioned before, when I lived in Cardiff, one was getting public transport. When you're a wheelchair user, luckily in the UK, a lot of public transport is accessible in theory. In practice, it often doesn't materialize in that way. And I found, for example, I used to work as a primary school teacher. I'd go to work and then end up waiting ages for a bus because they couldn't actually be bothered to get the ramp out, so they'd just drive past. Or if you're on a train, they forget you there. I've ended up 2 hours away from where I was supposed to be because they'd forgotten about me and ended up at the end of the line. So for me, reclaiming my transport freedom really did come with my hand cycle. And I found that when I was still in rehab, just because I chanced across an advert for someone selling one secondhand. And I was desperate to get back into nature and the green. And one of my main concerns, I wasn't fussed about all the rest of becoming and going on wheels, but not being able to be as one with nature and having more of an impact on the planet was a concern. And thankfully, this turned out to be my tool for freedom. Recently, a friend was getting married in Istanbul in Turkey, which is quite far away. And I'm pretty committed to not flying, so I had to find another way of getting there. And the obvious choice is probably not to try and cycle there. But with a combination of a hand cycle, a very generous month off work, or my annual leave, and again, willing ex-boyfriend who was up for piggybacking me onto inaccessible transport, we were able to make that happen. And I think that demonstrates that even when infrastructure is not there in various countries in the Balkans, for example, you can get on a train for free if you're a wheelchair user in Romania, but the train is about this high in the air with 10 steps. So free if you can do it. It's a very cheap policy. I recommend the current government look into that one. It could work out in their favor. But what it showed to me is that accessibility and transport freedom is a mixture of the infrastructure that you have and the attitudes that surround you. And it does mean opening up your world more to people, but it also means that all of you in the audience and everyone else has kind of a responsibility to make that happen and the power to make that happen, whether that's advocating for not having to piggyback people in so that you can save your backs, or if that's just making something a little bit more smooth to get through, widening a gate or telling your local council that the kissing gate that they've put in is not open to other people. And even if it works for you, just thinking about who else it could maybe not be working for. So it was that mixture of things. I ended up being able to cycle to work an hour each way at my school, and I could chain up my cycle there. But again, that's a huge privilege. You can buy a bike for a couple of £100. A hand cycle like that will cost you about £5,000 to £7,000. And there are many other cycles that would cost you similar, 10 to 12 times the price of any standard bike. And there is no funding or support for that. You can get a £30,000 car through Motability, but you have no chance to getting a cycle. So unless you're really lucky and you can find one secondhand that will still cost you a couple grand, or you can convince a nice charity to help you out, for a lot of people that's not even something that they consider. And with a lack of visibility, because the costs are so high, people don't even realize they can cycle, which is one of the reasons that the work that I do now is really important.
Thank you. Now, this is we want this to be a bit of an interactive session to learn from each other. I just wonder if there's one or two examples from the audience, if anybody would like to talk about something that's either positively or negatively affected their transport freedom curve, perhaps a personal circumstance.
Okay, hello. I've made my little curve. Is that the right way around? So I grew up in a really, really rural village. So this little lump is me learning to cycle, maybe 5 or 6, could then cycle to surrounding villages. This is me then going to uni in a city where they have buses multiple times a day, multiple times an hour. It's fantastic. And I then moved back home from the city, back to my village. Haven't been able to get my driving license because I turned 17 in 2020 when it was illegal to have driving lessons, then went straight to uni. So I'm 22 and can't drive and really sad about it, but really trying to. So yeah, hopefully at some point this will tip up and I will get an ability to kind of move around independently. But for now, it's me and my bike and the A34.
Thank you.
Just one more perhaps?
Yeah, one more. Yes, you just... just the lady here at the front. Lots of choice.
Hi, my uplift at the end is my e-bike, which, being not as young as I was at all, I'm moving to a city with hills. I got borrowed an e-bike at the beginning of lockdown from work and started using it much more. And I now have my own e-bike and I have now also sold my car. And I use it, I'm a social worker and I use it for all my visits and I can get up any hill in Worcester. So that has definitely increased my cycle freedom. It does mean that I get to be grumpy and swear a lot because the traffic is pretty rubbish, but that, I mean, that's always good, get stuff out, isn't it? But yeah, my e-bike has been a delight and has definitely improved my freedom, and I have great conversations with people about it as well in my job.
Amazing, thank you. So we've explored there some personal circumstances and we've also started to pull out some of those personal enablers like an e-bike or a hand cycle. And now we're going to go on to those external factors and the kind of system that we operate in. So those are the kind of streets outside of your house and the infrastructure that we use, to the policies that we write, and to the kind of transport providers, whether that be bus or rail. So we're going to go back to our panel again and hear from them. So starting with you, Rosa, as the infrastructure campaigner for your neck of the woods, I'm hopeful that you can say something positive about transformational infrastructure.
One of the roads on my way to school has recently been developed, and so cyclists used to have to share the pavement with pedestrians, but now there's a separate protected cycle lane, which makes my route to school a lot safer, and there's more crossings and safer junctions along the road as well. And this means I don't have to think about the road too much because it's protected and it's away from all the traffic, and me and my friend can just cycle to school without the need to worry about cars or whatever happens with the traffic and things like that. So yeah,
thank you. And I could just say as well, from the other side of working for that route, we're already seeing people putting their, you know, yeah, more people cycling on that. The levels of cycling are really rising, so it is very much a case of like build it and they will come. It's great to see lots of people using that route in Cambridge. It's Milton Road. Now over to Alan. So is there another external factor that might have had an influence on your transport freedom?
I think one of the things that's really helped me is that in the last few years, I've started teaching bikeability in primary schools. Now, I've been riding bikes for quite a while, but some of the techniques that I have learned to teach to children have given me a lot more confidence on the road. Do you know that bicycles have been reckoned to be unsafe on the road for a long time? There was a move in the late 1800s to get bikes off the road because they were frightening horses. And the Road Traffic Acts 1894 and 1895 confirm that bicycles are allowed to ride on the road. There was another move to get rid of bikes when the numbers of cars increased exponentially in this country in the 1960s and 1970s. So the Road Traffic Act 1968 reaffirms that a bicycle ridden on the road has all of the privileges as well as responsibilities of any other road user. But in 2022, there was a hierarchy of responsibility that was legally established. And that means that drivers of larger vehicles have a responsibility to take care of those in smaller vehicles and more vulnerable road users. So that means that when you're on a bike, you've got to look out for pedestrians. When you're on a motorcycle, you've got to look out for pedestrians and cyclists. When you're in a car, you've got to think about motorcyclists as well. And when you're driving a bus, well, you get the idea. And that means that I can stick out on the road and I can know with some degree of confidence that it is the duty of the people round me to look after me as a vulnerable road user. I can't be an idiot and get away with it, but if I'm being a sensible road user, then at least legally I'm in the clear, and what's more, I'm still alive.
Thanks, Alan. Laura, over to you. Perhaps touching on your experience of rural isolation and the importance of rural routes.
Yeah. So last year I had a book published about the National Cycle Network, and I got to meet some amazing people who had been campaigning for cycle routes and building cycle routes actually for the last 30 or so years in the UK. And it was an amazing experience. I got to meet lots of great campaigners and people who in Sustrans who were delivering paths and helping improve people's transport freedom. But one thing that I was very aware of was how difficult it can be to build cycle routes, both in urban areas and in rural areas, because of, you know, everything in the transport system is designed for delivering roads for cars. And so in urban areas, a lot of the bike routes are missing, because if you want to build bike lanes in cities, then you have to contend with motor vehicle space, and it's a very contested space. And in the countryside, you've got landowner issues and planning permission and funding. And I met the most amazing people. I met this chap in Frome who's been working on the same 5-kilometer, 3-mile stretch of path linking a nice flat route to the town of Frome. He's been doing that for 20 years and he's still somehow smiling. It's amazing. And he's dealt with so many landowners. They've come up with 10 or 11 different routes because one landowner doesn't want it. And then at one point, there's 3 generations of landowners. The first one wanted it. He died. The son didn't want it. And then he died, and then the grandson is finally on board, and so they're able to proceed. But it's an incredibly hard process. What should be a very, very beneficial means of transport, cycling, the benefit cost ratios that transport planners love, and funding, how we calculate funding, are huge for cycle routes. And even in the countryside, they're great for health and tourism and all of these things. But it's very, very hard. So after the book, I applied for some funding to try and work out what the campaigners who were doing the successful paths were doing right, and how to kind of spread that knowledge around, because there are, there's no kind of magic wand, but there are sort of similar things that people are doing which are getting this process moved forward. So I heard one person talk about it takes 10 years to deliver a path. 9 of those are just kind of working out how to do it, and then it's 1 year to deliver. And I thought, well, if you can shortcut some of that, then we can get a lot more rural paths, and that has a huge impact on people. I've been speaking to amazing campaigners around the country. I spoke to someone in Scotland this week just gone. They've been building a path up in rural West Scotland, and they say since they've opened it, all sorts of people are now cycling from one of the small towns to the bigger towns to work. There's people who use wheelchairs who are able to go out and about in the countryside under their own steam for the first time, and kids are learning to ride bikes and all of that. So that's
you know, that's kind of an amazing thing, but it needs to be much easier, obviously, to deliver these paths, because at the moment it's really an uphill battle and it's almost kind of Kafkaesque at points. It's just so difficult. You really need to be just incredibly pig-headed, I guess, and very optimistic, like this chap in Froome. He just never gives up, basically. He's like, oh, well, you know, there's always another way. And it's just, I don't know, I find it amazing, but it shouldn't really be that hard. So, yeah, that's my bit.
Yeah. And Katie, just thinking again about that external environment, are there any particular barriers to on cycle routes that you've experienced as well that make your journeys difficult?
I'd say as we kind of make this push towards a more active travel-based future and we become more aware of the fact that fossil fuels are finite and we are going to have to transition, I think it's just that reminder that any push to a change has to be one with a mobility justice lens, and it has to be a just transition that happens. And so I talked before about cycle loan schemes, for example, and using the Cardiff equivalent to Boris Bikes. Nothing similar to that exists at the moment except this trial scheme that we're currently running in London. And even that has obviously a lot of barriers because things have to be very specific. Disabled people are not an easy tick box, and it does take a lot of investment and sometimes a lot of money, though it doesn't necessarily have to. So there's the actual equipment aspect to it, but then there's also, we found through running our own scheme that a lot of people had these cycles and they loved them and they were great freedom in theory, but then the way that people drive or the infrastructure that we're building, if you're building a tiny width cycle lane, that's not going to work with someone on a side-by-side cycle, or you're approaching a gate and there's just one way of opening it. That doesn't work for people. And I often find, you know, if I put on Google Maps and I put the cycle route mapper, it won't tell me about those gates or barriers. It won't tell me when a pavement ends with no drop curb and that I'm stuck. Unlike some people, I can't get off my cycle and push it. I am genuinely stuck until someone comes and rescues me. And so without being able to plan our journeys, a lot of people really do feel limited, and they're small changes that are really easy to make. And I think we can do a kind of form of citizen science or citizen activism, where every time you encounter a drop curb that's not there or a gate which you think someone might struggle to get through, report that to your council. They do have a duty of care to have that removed. Even in terms of legislation, we're really not there. Cycles at the moment and wheelchairs are all classed on the scale of invalid carriage, which is a rather outdated term, as you can imagine. Thankfully, they are now looking at that and looking at reclassifying things. The legislation around e-scooters and banning of e-bikes, all of that, there's a mobility justice element which we need to watch really carefully and make sure that people aren't being excluded as we make these changes. But there's a lot of small things that we can do, and there's a lot of big things that we can do. And I think we just need to dream big, remember that we all have a role to play in that, and continue to push for a just future.
Thank you. Loads of really, really great points there. And I wonder if we could just get maybe one or two more points from the audience. So anybody would like to say about the influence of policy or infrastructure or the external environment? Can we just do go in the glasses?
Hello, yeah. Vincent from Manchester. Bikeability instructor, Alan, yes, as well. Pavement parking. I just spent a week in Scotland at the Edinburgh Fringe. And in Scotland, they park on the road, not the pavement. Even the narrowest of roads, they don't infringe the pavement, so it's free for what pavement's for pedestrians. And also, of course, narrowing the highway, the impact of that just slow traffic. But of course, in England, even on the widest roads, everyone parks the cars on the pavement. You know, is it protect their wing mirrors or something? So apparently, is London, is it different? I don't know, but I would say, and I think there's some government consultation about pavement parking, which has gone on forever. So, yeah, what are we going to do about pavement parking?
And can we just have the girl behind you?
One of my high points in travel freedom is when the COVID pandemic came around, because there were fewer cars on the roads, which meant that me and my family could travel and like cycle more to more places together, and it was much more safe for young children.
Uh, thank you so much. It's so important to hear people's stories and get different perspectives on things, and especially when we're talking about the external environment and policies, politicians. It's really easy to think that we don't have input on that. We have the biggest impact we have is within our personal lives, but part of the reason that Josh and I are here today is to reassure you that you absolutely can make a difference. Laura's touched on it, Katie's touched on it, many other people have touched on that today, so I want to sort of just tell everybody in the room today that you can be a transport campaigner. You don't need special skills, you just need your stories and your vision for a better future. And this doesn't even have to be hard. Whatever perspectives and skills you bring, you can use. And so just for one other example, I have from Cambridgeshire. So there is a village, Foulmere. Recently that village tripled bus use in the village. And how did they do this? Did they take on the might of Stagecoach, or did they have a really long political kind of campaign? No, none of that. Simply what they did is they collated all of the bus timetables into one place in a nice, easy to understand way. They delivered it to every person in the village. They had it up in the local shop. They made sure every bus shelter had a timetable, and they put it in the parish news. That is literally all they did, and they tripled bus usage. So really increasing people's personal travel freedom and creating a better place for everyone. And you can do things like that too.
So Laura, I wanted to you've cycled the breadth of Britain, and you've seen people taking 10 years to deliver a path in
20,
but I'm sure you've also seen the impact that people can have and the differences that they can make and the change that can bring about.
I have. And you really can. People don't really write to their local councillors, politicians very much, and so when you do, it has a really big impact. And you can put your support forward for different ways of delivering transport. And if you're in a city region, I think that's fantastic. And there's more city regions coming on board, but they have transport budgets, and you can start to campaign for barrier removal. You can talk about resurfacing, or maintenance is really important of routes, because if they start to get overgrown, nobody uses them. But it's amazing. I've met people who have campaigned and got funding for paths, bringing back railway lines to greenways, and you really can have a big impact on your local area. And I think it's quite easy to forget that, and there's something very powerful about speaking to your people in your community, to your politicians, and face to face is very important as well, because it's very easy to be on social media and to shout at the world, but that face-to-face really has a huge impact on our communities, and you can have a voice. So,
and Katie, I wonder if there's any Wheels for Wellbeing campaigns that people out in the audience here could support.
So we've got my cycle my mobility aid campaign, which is currently active at the moment. There's also been more of a campaign against recently. Someone had their entire wheelchair and front attachment impounded by the police as an illegal device, and kind of was housebound as a result of that, which is more of a kind of more than house arrest that you give someone who's committed a crime rather than someone who fell out of their wheelchair. So some outrage around that kind of thing is obviously very, very helpful. If you know someone who maybe has a mobility impairment, or even just an older age, and thinks they might like to cycle but doesn't know how, we've got our Wheels for Me scheme, which has a nationwide advice line, and you can call me and I will give you some advice about how you can get into cycling in your local area. Unfortunately, things are quite limited, but we're all going to end up disabled at some point in your life, and everybody knows somebody who, even if they don't consider themselves as having an impairment, cycling doesn't have to be difficult. We heard about e-bikes being really great tools of freedom. A lot of people are very proud about it. I know you're a bikeability instructor, and they're working really hard to try and increase the availability of non-standard cycles in schools as well, but there's more that can be done there. A lot of children are forced to learn on a two-wheeled cycle when maybe they would actually benefit from having a tricycle, and it's not a downward step. You're not going back to being a baby if you use a tricycle. They can be pretty cool and snazzy as well. So just getting over that kind of ego thing and a lack of awareness, and supporting visibility of non-standard cycles and cycling, whatever that looks like.
Great. We've got time to go to the audience now, and we want to hear about any campaigning successes you may have had for transport planning, or any campaigning ideas that you just want to put out in the ether, float the shit and share those ideas around. So just 5 minutes with the audience.
Annie from Greater Manchester. I wrote to Greater Transport for Manchester because we're quite badly served for routes round to the airport and the other parts of Manchester. And there's a couple of lines which are shared by the metro and the train line, and I mapped it out for them how they could improve some transport. And actually, there was recently, just the other week, there's been a published document, and they're actually going to do a feasibility study on it. So I'm very, very pleased.
Any ideas how we can campaign to get more cyclists to Greenbelt? So I was supposed to cycle this year but couldn't because I was injured, but next year I'll be back on my bike. But free showers on Thursdays? Yeah?
Definitely definitely could do more, but two of us on this stage cycled to Greenbelt this year, and if you hunt out those green fairies, you do get some tokens for some discount food. So they're doing stuff, but maybe some more, and some showers definitely could come into the picture.
A couple of points. I'm here by rail today, and even as a senior rail card holder, I'm shocked at how high rail prices have become recently. Another point, we don't seem to be very good in the UK as a whole at integrating public transport so that buses are directly outside railway stations. Sometimes the bus station is even a mile away from the railway station, and if you're new in town, the temptation is to take a taxi instead of using the bus. Any thoughts?
I think there's also a problem with integrating bus and rail time. So so Rosa, who is my daughter, she was talking about having to wait in a phone box at a rural station near my parents. And actually, that's, you know, there was a bus, but it's in 2 hours' time. It's like, well, if you get in and you have to then wait 2 hours for a bus in the snow, it's not, you know, not really joining up there. Thank you everybody for your insight. We are really getting to the end of our journey here now in the hothouse. So have a look at the curves you've created and maybe like turn and compare with the people next to you, see what differences and similarities there might be. One of the most really important things you can do as a transport campaigner, and Laura has mentioned this several times, both today and yesterday in her talk, is talk to people, and ideally in person if you can. It's like so, so powerful. So talk to your family, your friends, your neighbours, other campaigners, your politicians. It's really important to share your stories, just like our wonderful panel have done today. So please give them a big round of applause. It's really important to understand other people's perspectives, put yourself in their shoes and find areas of common ground so that together we can work for a place where everybody, whatever their age, stage or situation, has a more choice in transport and more steady transport freedom throughout their life, while also at the same time building a greener, fairer world. And remember, everybody in this room, you can be a transport campaigner no matter what your story is, what skills you bring. We need them all. So now go and please do it. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.